This is Background Briefing, and I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Samia Sarigaldan, who is a writer, political essayist, editor, and literary critic. She was born and raised in Egypt, educated in Europe, and then emigrated to the United States. Her autobiographical novel, The Cairo House, traces political developments in Egypt over the past three decades, including the rise of Islamism and Sadat's assassination. She joins us from Cairo. And on day two of the revolution, or the pre-revolution, what did you witness today in the streets of Cairo, Samia?
Maybe a little soon to call it a pre-revolution or a revolution. Time will tell, but certainly a second day of massive demonstrations and protests across the country, and that's very, very momentous for Egypt because the law of assembly that makes it illegal under martial law has meant that.
Are you there? You were saying the imposition of martial law has meant. So if you could just pick it up from there.
Right. And that's since Sadat's assassination. So that's 30 years ago now. The assembly is illegal. And that's pretty much kept any protest or demonstration, at least any massive ones, off the streets in Egypt. But the Tunisian example seems to have been a great gargoyle moment, a moment when it was revealed that things were possible and people have started demonstrating and protesting and flooding the streets, something unheard of, unimaginable until very, very recently, a sort of audacity of hope that the Tunisian example has for Egyptians, and that's the great excitement that's going on right now. No one really knows what the results will be of this. There's a fair amount of dread along with a hope, but at the same time, it's extremely exciting because this is so unimaginable up to a few weeks ago before the Tunisian example made it seem that everything is possible. So that's very remarkable in itself. So a second day of protests and demonstrations. The police seem to have held their fire, at least at the beginning. But as they went on, of course, the protests were broken up. But just the fact that the police did not come down in force right away is, again, significant. Also reports coming in from the provinces, not just from Cairo, but from the provinces as well. And this is all building up on months of widespread discontent from many, many different levels of society, not necessarily the poorest, university professors, the judiciary, lawyers, judges in particular, who were pretty much sidelined during the recent October elections and felt humiliated, felt sidelined. All of these levels of protests have been building up, but there was not the courage to go ahead with protests until the past 2 days. So that's very, very remarkable.
So, again, Samia Sarigaldan, who is in Cairo, the author of The Cairo House, who we're talking about today, the day after yesterday's street protests that were called the Day of Anger. They coincided with Police Day. And I guess the fact that they started out being nice to the police and trying to co-opt them, and after a while, somebody must have given the police orders to get tough, right?
Yes. But they did hold fire for a very long time and quite often let the demonstrators through, at least that's what it looks like or what's been reported, for a while. So again, either that was under orders or just that day that the police themselves were not sure what they should be doing or felt perhaps some sympathy with what was going on. But I think it had largely to do with the fact that the demonstrators made a point of not being confrontational, but their triple mass messages all stressed that they would not be violent. And as you know, Twitter and Facebook and so on came down, were blocked early on, since yesterday, Twitter's been off and Facebook to a large extent. because those social networks were used to organize protests, and just as cell phones were used to post videos on YouTube, including a sort of Tiananmen Square moment. But I think the most important thing is that the demand up to now, forget the slogans, forget the people are chanting in the street, but the demand, the actual demand so far has been fairly limited. Dissolution of parliament, new elections that would not be fraudulent, resignation of the Minister of the Interior, and raising the minimum wage. Because although the government has in recent years been vaunting its growth of Egypt, but that has not seemed to trickle down to the masses who are suffering increasingly because some food subsidies have been, and food prices have gone up massively. And unemployment is rampant. Job opportunities for the educated are even less available than for the uneducated. And that's building up on the discontent and the feeling that whatever the growth rate in Egypt, it's not trickling down to the majority of people. And that is stressing the great disparity in income, plus the fact that in recent years there has been a relatively high degree of freedom of the press, means that the opposition press has been reporting scandals, corruption among government officials and business tycoons. And in many cases, those are one and the same. The business tycoons are government officials or ministers. And that led to a perception of not only massive income disparity, but also massive corruption. And that has been one of the strongest rallying points for these protests.
And Egypt, of course, is a country where 40% of the nation lives on less than $2 a day. And when you talk about raising the minimum wage, it's obviously got nowhere to go but up. I take it, though, that most of these demonstrations represent the younger generation in Egypt who are born after the 82-year-old Hosni Mubarak came to power in 1981.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And again, so far, the protesters do not seem to be the poorest of the poor by any means. They seem to be largely middle-class university students, younger people, as you said yourself, more with some level of education at any rate, technically savvy with cell phones and computers and so on. But that's rather typical of such movements, that they would be in the forefront. They're often joined by people in the street, but this movement is clearly not led by the poorest of the poor. Unlike the bread strikes during Sadat's time, the very serious bread strikes during Sadat's time that were very much a mass movement of people who are really on the poverty line, and those were the striking factory workers and very poor people. This is not the case this time. It's mostly, as you said, very young people who were born into the Mubarak regime, but also there is very widespread support, as I said, among university professors who've had a movement called the 9th of March against what they perceived as academic or non-freedom of academia. Judges, lawyers, the judiciary, it's very much wider spread than just the students and young people who see no future and no jobs. So I think that's important to keep in mind.
It seems, though, from what I can glean from press reports, Samia Sarigeldin, again, the author of The Cairo House, which has traced the political development of Egypt for the past three decades, and including the rise of Islamism and Sadat's assassination, and she's joining us from Cairo. It seems to me that the Egyptian spirit is wounded. This is a sort of wounded country. I take it that a lot of Egyptians watching the revolution in Tunisia were in effect embarrassed at their own weakness in contrast to the courage of the Tunisians. And is this true that there's a sense that this country that was the heart of the Arab world and particularly of Arab intellectualism has languished over the decades?
Your interpretation is perfectly on target. It's a perfectly on target interpretation, because in effect, there were several copycat attempts on the part of Egyptians to copy the martyrdom of the Tunisian street vendor who set fire to himself. There were several attempts and people who died in the attempt, setting fire to themselves, throwing themselves off of buildings. And there was a very strong feeling that in the streets that the Tunisians are men, as Arabs put it in Arabic, and that Egyptians needed to show the same kind of guts. And really, it's almost a sense of the emperor has no clothes, but closer to the Zardoz moment in that film when the curtain is pulled aside and it's shown that it is possible. So the fact that the Tunisians could do it, and could do it in 2 or 3 days, they could bring about this change, this massive, unimaginable change when Ben Ali had been in power for almost as long as Mubarak. I think everyone believes was the great catalyst for the inspiration for this massive street movement. Now, whether it brings about the same change in a country so much larger, more powerful, more complex than Tunisia, and with a geopolitical position that is so much more critical to global politics than is Tunisia, because of Egypt's involvement in peace treaties in the region and so on. Whether this will be allowed to happen in Egypt or whether it could happen is another matter altogether. Plus, in Tunisia, the army stood aside. The army has not spoken in Egypt yet, and I'm sure you know that that is what, in the end, will tip the balance one way or the other, because the police has been used, yes, and the police is a tremendous force in Egypt, and in recent years, the police force has been seen as not representing the service of the people, but representing the security apparatus for the regime, and the police itself has been the focus of a great deal of criticism on the part of ordinary citizens and complaints about police brutality. At the moment, all of these complaints are focused on the Minister of the Interior, who runs the police force. But as I said, the police has been used. The army has not been called into play at all. And that is a very crucial matter. And again, the status of Egypt in global politics is very different from that of Tunisia. So what is imaginable for Tunisia may not be imaginable for Egypt, but for the people in the streets, there is a tremendous urge for change. And as you said, in a sense, we heard several protesters in the streets saying, we're not being treated as human beings. Our intelligence is being insulted when there are elections with results that show more than 98% of the vote going to the NDP, the National Party, which is Mubarak's party. They feel their intelligence is being insulted. They feel their humanity is being insulted when they are not treated as whole citizens. And again, the press the opposition press in recent years has had the freedom to make this kind of point, to tell the Egyptian citizen, are you a man or a mouse? Can you make yourself heard? And so on. And yesterday and today, they've been heard. But whether they would be satisfied with a limited result or push for a more radical change, that's not clear. At this point, it is not clear.
Well, in a way, Samir Saragelden, you're describing what happened recently in Iran, in the sense that the Iranian people were so insulted by the election being stolen that they rose up. And, of course, we know what their fate was. When you said that Egypt is, of course, so different from Tunisia and it's very geostrategically important and it has peace treaties with Israel, etc., that it won't be allowed to fall apart, that implies that somebody outside of Egypt is holding it together. So explain that.
Just to go back for a minute to what you said about Iran, I should say that, again, the Iranian example was one followed very, very closely in Egypt. I do want to pick up on your remark there, that the Iranian example also was followed very closely in Egypt. And admired and used as a model. But I would, without going into speculation, I think it's something that's really hard to argue against, that the superpowers around the world have a very strong vested interest in Egypt, and the U.S. in particular has a very strong vested interest in security in the region and in the role that it sees Egypt, which is its client state, as far as aid is concerned, the role that it sees Egypt playing, and the fact that it has, of course, a tremendous influence, if only through the billions in aid that come to Egypt from the U.S. So it's very much, I would say it's apparent that the U.S. at least can play a tremendous role in the area, but also other players in the region, regional players, as well as the U.S. will have a strong interest in the outcome.
Well, clearly, by the way, the U.S. aid to Egypt, $1.2 billion a year, is mostly military aid. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, in a press conference, told reporters yesterday that the Egyptian government is stable and looking for ways to respond to the legitimate needs and interests of the Egyptian people. Does that strike you as being what's happening there with the Egyptian government?
It's hard to tell at this point if Secretary Clinton's assessment of the stability of Egypt is entirely justified. Hard to tell at this point. The fact is that the roots of discontent are very deep, and I think one outcome, at any rate, is that it will be very hard for President Mubarak to pass on the succession to his son, because much of the resentment has focused on the idea of a succession. What is called in Egypt the inheritance scenario, inheritance from father to son, as was the case in Iraq or in Syria or in other countries of the region. So I think this will these demonstrations and protests will very much reinforce this rejection of the inheritance scenario. So therefore, now it will be, since President Mubarak is an elderly man, again, the question will pose itself even more urgently, and events today and yesterday will certainly influence that outcome. So I think Secretary Clinton was speaking possibly prescriptively, as descriptively possibly, when she talked about the stability of Egypt. Perhaps she was reassuring as much as commenting.
Well, just in closing, Samia Saragalan, telephoning you has been difficult when the line's been cut off a bunch of times and there are reports that the government is trying to close down social networks and texting and cell phone interference. And is that happening? I'm not suggesting that they're trying to diminish this call, although it's taken us a while to get through to you and the quality hasn't been good.
I know for certain that Twitter, for instance, has been down since yesterday. Also, some of the websites of some of the opposition press were down. They may be up again, but some of them were down. So some websites have been down. Twitter has been down. Facebook has been down. This phone call was interrupted 3 or 4 times. Other phone calls from overseas were not. So that's about as far as I care to comment at this point.
Well, I thank you for joining us here in Los Angeles, Samia Saragalan. Thank you so much for joining us from Cairo.
Very much enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
I did too. Again, I've been speaking with Samia Saragalan, who's a writer, political essayist, editor, and literary critic. She was born and raised in Egypt, educated in Europe, and then emigrated to the United States. Her autobiographical novel, The Cairo House, traces political developments in Egypt over the past 3 decades, including the rise of Islamism and Sadat's assassination. And she joined us today from Cairo.